طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relative to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. We ask our listeners, as we do every week, were you involved last week in the Palestinian-Israel peace movement and the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's savage military attacks against them to force them out of their homes and annex their properties into Israel? Did you speak out on the atrocities Israel is committing every day in Gaza and the West Bank? If not, why not? What is your reason not to? We cannot overemphasize to our listeners that the best thing you can do is to go to Palestine and experience the situation on the ground for yourselves. There is nothing that can bring home to you the realities on the ground in Palestine than to go there and see for yourselves. Never mind what you hear out of the filter of the mainstream media, or for that matter, what you may hear in this program. The best way to discover the truth is to go and see for yourselves. Nothing that you may have read or heard could prepare you for what you will see. It is Sunday, June 21st, 2009. We begin with a brief summary of news highlights and some commentary. The mainstream media focused its attention last week on the violence that followed the presidential elections in Iran and regarding Palestine on Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech last Sunday, June 14th. President Obama welcomed Netanyahu's speech, saying that his backing of a demilitarized Palestinian state was a, quote, positive movement, unquote. This was clearly the expected obligatory diplomatic reaction to emphasize the positive. One might have been tempted to hope that Obama would deal with Israel in the usual way of applying private pressure rather than show public displeasure. But he had already shown his hand by publicly voicing support for freezing all settlement construction in his speech in Cairo. And predictably, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee got busy and got the signatures of 329 members of Congress, including key figures in both parties, on a letter calling on the administration to work closely and privately with Israel in contrast to the current public pressure. But as we have learned from Mr. Obama's dealings with the economy and other matters, the president favors consensus over confrontation. So it came as no surprise when Israel's Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman emerged from a meeting with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton last Wednesday and declared that there will not be a complete freeze on settlement construction. In his speech, Prime Minister Netanyahu laid the following terms and conditions for his acceptance of a Palestinian state. 1. Palestinians must recognize Israel as a Jewish state. 2. The Palestinian state must be demilitarized. 3. Jerusalem must not be divided and must be the capital of Israel. 4. Settlement growth construction will continue. And 5. Consistent with Israel being a Jewish state, the Palestinian right of return to their homes is off the table. Official reactions in Palestine, Syria, and Egypt to the speech were swift. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas said he would not resume talks unless Israel honored previous pledges to halt settlement construction. Egyptian President Mubarak said that the speech scuttled chances for peace, and Syria said that Netanyahu's plan contains everything but peace. Clearly, all of Netanyahu's five conditions are unacceptable on their face. But what do people expect? Since when does a colonial, military occupier and persecutor retreat amicably in cooperation with the people it is persecuting? It is a historical truism that the freedom of persecuted peoples has to be wrested by force from their persecutors. Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech was billed as a response to President Obama's public adoption of the U.S. policy of seeking a two-state solution to the fighting in Palestine-Israel. But it was really a defiant speech. Netanyahu clearly defied the United States' call to freeze all settlement construction and all but scuttled the idea of a viable sovereign Palestinian state in line with the Likud charter. The Likud platform, as shown at the Knesset website, clearly states that, and I quote, "The government of Israel flatly rejects the establishment of a Palestinian Arab state west of the Jordan River. The Palestinians can run their lives freely in the framework of self-rule, but not as an independent and sovereign state." Unquote. So what is the Obama administration to do? The American Israel Public Affairs Committee may have been shaken a little by the spying case brought against it and dropped, but it has retained much of its clout. And the U.S. Congress is still Israel's private property. The most he can do without appearing to turn tail is resort to the face-saving device of redefining what he meant by freezing settlement construction as freezing new settlement construction, not freezing natural growth construction. Does all of this mean that there is no hope for meaningful pressure on Israel, without which there can be no end to these 62 years of Israeli ethnic cleansing and persecution of Palestinians? The answer to that question is no, there is great hope when Israel's fraudulent public image is finally acknowledged to be a fraud. Former President Jimmy Carter visited Gaza on Tuesday. Speaking at an award ceremony for UN refugee school pupils, he said, quote, "Tragically, the international community largely ignores the cries for help, while the citizens of Gaza are treated more like animals than human beings." Carter said he had asked Israeli officials to explain the blockade and why items like paper and crayons were banned from Gaza. "I sought an explanation for this policy in Israel, but did not receive a satisfactory answer, because there is none," he said. "The responsibility for this terrible human rights crime," he added, "lies in Jerusalem, Cairo, Washington, and throughout the international community. This abuse must cease. The crimes must be investigated, the walls must be brought down, and the basic right of freedom must come to you." End of quote. We remain unwaveringly optimistic about the future. The mountains of lies and deceptions that Israel had heaped around the globe will crumble, and its bullying of the international community will end, and Palestinians will gain their freedom. The organization Defense for Children International, known as DCI Palestine, released its annual report on Saturday, June 13th, on the treatment of Palestinian children at the hands of Israelis. The report contains chilling details of how children are deliberately abused and tortured by Israeli authorities. We discuss today the findings of this report with Australian attorney and DCI officer Gerard Horton. Mr. Horton is an international advocacy officer for Defense for Children International Palestine section. He first went to Palestine in December 2006 as a volunteer for Ad-Damir, a Palestinian prisoners' rights organization. He returned to Palestine in August 2007, volunteering with DCIPS, and started in his position as international advocacy officer in January of 2008. He joins us now by telephone from Palestine. Good afternoon, Mr. Gerard Horton, and thanks for being our guest today.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Please talk to us about your organization, Defense for Children International Palestine Section, and what it does.
Yes, it's the leading child rights organization in Palestine. There are about 50 employees and 4 offices throughout the West Bank. We have 5 Palestinian lawyers and 12 Palestinian field workers dotted around the West Bank and in Gaza. Some of those lawyers appear for Palestinian children in the 2 military courts, which prosecute children in the West Bank and do what they can to try and defend those children. The organization is also part of a wider international movement which is based in Geneva, and it has about 45 offices around the world.
The DCI report that was released a week ago Saturday, I believe, is very painful to read. Could you share with us some of the findings of your investigations?
Yes, it's the title of the report is Palestinian Child Prisoners, the Systematic and Institutionalized Ill-Treatment and Torture of Palestinian Children by Israeli Authorities. And what it is it's based on sworn affidavits collected by our field workers and lawyers throughout 2008 and 2009. During that period, 2008, our lawyers represented some 265 Palestinian children who were prosecuted in the military courts. That works out at about 30 to 40%, nearer 40% of the total number of children who are prosecuted in those courts each year, which on average is about 700 children go through those military courts every year, out of a total number of about, on average, 9,000 Palestinians who get prosecuted in the military courts. Those affidavits are collected by our lawyers from Palestinian children whilst they're in interrogation and detention centres and prisons, and also once they get released from prison. What we found was that in almost every single case that we receive, the abuse that these children receive is widespread, systematic, and commonplace. It tends to happen at every stage of the process, which commences typically at the arrest point, either at a checkpoint, in a village street, near the wall, near some settlements, or from the child's bed at in the early hours of the morning. What typically happens is the soldiers grab the children, often after there have been some sort of clashes. As you would, and your listeners would be aware, clashes often break out of children throwing stones at the wall, near the wall, near settlements, near settler bypass roads, and places like that. And what we find is either the children are arrested close to the time of those clashes, or what sometimes happens is a few days later, soldiers from the Israeli army will enter the village near where those clashes occurred, usually between the hours of around midnight and 4 a.m. They then start rounding up children. Usually they have names of particular children they want to arrest. Sometimes not, they just round up children of a certain age category. What will happen is they'll then tie the hands of the child behind their back with plastic ties, which an Israeli human rights organization, in one of their reports, Pekati, found that those plastic ties usually are tied so tight that they often cut off blood supply to the hands and cut into the flesh. They'll blindfold the child. They will then bundle the child into the back of a military vehicle. In almost no cases are the parents of the child told why the child has been arrested or where the child has been taken to. The child is, once in the back of the vehicle, is either alone with the soldiers who arrested the child, or sometimes there's some other children in the vehicle as well. Usually the children are placed on the floor of the vehicle and the soldiers are sitting on the seats around the child. Typically there'll be some forms of abuse during that transfer process. The soldiers will kick the children quite often, or just put their feet on the children, slap the children, verbally abuse the children. This transfer process takes anywhere from about 20 minutes to several hours, depending on where the village is and where the interrogation and detention center is located. On arrival at the interrogation and detention center, which is usually in the West Bank, although there are some the children are taken to inside Israel, the children are usually taken straight in for interrogation. They're interrogated by typically one interrogator, but sometimes up to three interrogators. In no case in 2008 or 2009 was a lawyer or the child's parents or any family member allowed to be with the child when they were being interrogated. Typically during the interrogation, threats will be made, some physical abuse will occur, slapping. Usually the child is still bound by the hand, sometimes shackled as well. Sometimes there's a form of position abuse, which often involves sitting the child in a very, very small chair, which is placed on an angle whilst the child's legs are shackled to the chair and hands are tied behind their back. And then after half an hour or so, this causes quite severe pain to the back. Depending on the age of the child, usually we find children as young as 12 sent to these interrogation and detention centres. Children that young tend to confess to anything very quickly. You must remember that they're fairly traumatised by the time they get to these interrogation centres, having been usually arrested and physically abused in the middle of the night. Older children sometimes take longer to confess to a crime, and often the measures used against older children are more severe than the younger children. We had a case which is reported in the report that we're discussing, where a child was tied in the shape of a cross to a wall and left like that for many hours. Older children between the ages around 16, 17 are often kept in solitary confinement for many days, which has a terrible psychological effect on the children. And usually after that treatment, those children confessed as well. What we found was in about 95% of cases, the children will give some form of confession. They're then taken to the military courts within 8 days, and it's in the military court that they typically see their lawyer for the very first time. The lawyer gets to see them for a matter of minutes to take instructions from the child, and invariably the child and adults plead guilty in this system. The reason almost everyone pleads guilty is in 91% of cases that we handled, the children are denied bail. So the child is going to stay in detention in most cases until they're sentenced. Now, if a child pleads guilty to throwing stones, a typical sentence is around 4 months. They will be sentenced within about 1 month of arrest. That time will be taken into consideration, so they'll then be released in about 3 months. If the child decides to fight the case, what will happen is the case, they'll remain in detention, as I mentioned, but the case won't come on for hearing for maybe 5 to 12 months. The hearing itself will take many months because usually there'll be a few soldiers who will give evidence against the child, saying that they saw the child throw stones. And invariably, all of those soldiers are not brought to court on the same day. So one soldier will give evidence, and then the court proceedings will have to be adjourned for a month or so until the other soldier can come. So at the end of the day, the child's probably not going to be sentenced if they decide to defend the case, or the trial process will not be concluded for well over 12 months. And then they run the risk that if they're found guilty, which in all probabilities they will be, they will get a sentence which may be 2 to 3 times greater than if they had pleaded guilty. So it's just not in the interest of the child to defend a case, even if they're innocent, because if they plead guilty, they'll be out within about 3 or 4 months. If they try and defend the case, they'll be in, and even if they're found innocent, they won't be released for at least 12 months.
But their confessions are in Hebrew, aren't they?
Some of them are. In a rough estimate, would be about 20 to 30% of the confessions are actually written in the Hebrew language, which none of these children understand.
Mm-hmm.
And what's very disturbing is the military court judges who know that these children do not speak Hebrew use these confessions written in Hebrew to sentence these children. And it's, you know, under the UN Convention Against Torture, such evidence is not admissible in a court, in any courtroom, and any evidence obtained under torture is not admissible either. But those principles are simply ignored.
And isn't it a fact that 5 to 12 months until, say this is the average, at the average time a child gets to see the lawyer, that's certainly sufficient time for any physical abuse and torture, for the effects of any physical abuse or torture to fade away.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of threats and abuse, physical abuse, that are meted out to young children tend not to leave marks or fairly minor marks, because if you arrest a 12 or 13-year-old in the middle of the night and you scream at that child, you slap that child, and you threaten that child with a very long prison term and with physical violence, and you threaten that child's family, most children are going to confess in a situation like that. And so it's quite rare that there are long-term marks left on these children. And like I said earlier, the lawyer tends to see the child for the very first time about 8 days after the arrest. So it's quite rare that there are physical marks, although in some cases where the plastic ties that I mentioned earlier have cut into the wrist, there are physical marks there. But we've had a number of cases where there are physical marks on a child, and this has been brought to the attention of the judge, and nothing effective happens.
And certainly the threats against the family weigh heavily on the child.
Very much so. I mean, some of those threats, we quite regularly get threats, and some of them are documented in the report, of the interrogator saying to the child, listen, we're going to arrest your mother or your father, you know, and you don't want us to arrest your father and bring him down here and insult him. Sometimes there have been threats of revoking a parent's work permit. If the parent has a work permit to work inside Israel, the threat is that that will be revoked unless the child confesses. We had a case last year where a child was abused during interrogation, accused of throwing stones, sentenced to 4 months, and then afterwards was to travel to Holland to speak to some Dutch school children about his experiences. But before he went, he filed a complaint with an Israeli organization called Yesh Din, and then they took up his case and complained to the Israeli military authorities. And because the child was under 16 and traveling with one of our lawyers and not with the child's parents, a permit had to be obtained from the Israeli authorities for the child to travel. And the child was told that he would not be given a permit to travel unless he withdrew his complaint. And so he withdrew his complaint.
There are children. There is a case that you mentioned, Ahmed, I believe, who was 10 years old.
Yeah, is that the case? That's under the military orders, children can be prosecuted in the military courts from the age of 12 up to the age of 15. As soon as they turn 16, they're treated as adults, in contrast with Israeli domestic law, where children don't reach the age of majority until they're 18. But children under 12 years still get arrested. What happens in those cases is that they are detained in police stations until the parents come and pay some sort of bond to have that child released. Now, in Azat's case, he was just 10 years old. And what happened last year was he was looking after the family shop in a little village, and some soldiers entered the shop and said they were looking for a handgun that they said his father owned. And Azat denied that his father had a handgun. And essentially they slapped him around and abused him for about 2 hours. They made him stand on one leg for a long time and slapped him. They laughed at him, humiliated him. And the most disturbing thing was at one point a soldier placed his assault rifle to Azat's head, and Azat started shivering out of fear, and the soldier just made fun of him because he was shivering, and then said to Azat that told him to tell him where the handgun was before he shoots him. And that, in that case, Azat's family were going to lodge a complaint, but then they reconsidered and decided not to because they were concerned about retaliation. But it received quite a bit of publicity, that case, understandably, because it was so shocking.
It is shocking. It is shocking how those soldiers could possibly abuse children as young as 10 in that fashion and traumatize them pretty much for the rest of their lives.
That's right. There's something that's very compelling, I think, in the report is it brings together 33 case studies documenting various sorts of abuse at various stages of the process. But then there's a 34th case study, which is a testimony from an Israeli soldier, commander of the Kfir Brigade. And what is fascinating and interesting and disturbing at the same time is this commander basically corroborates everything that has come before in the report. Basically what he says is they go into villages, they know people are innocent, they go into villages to disrupt the life of the village, to see if there is any militant activity. If they disrupt the life of the village, perhaps that will reveal itself. And he doesn't hesitate in acknowledging that they go in and they use physical force against people that they know to be innocent, to see what information they can get. And there have been many, many testimonies from Israeli soldiers who give evidence to that effect, that this is the policy of the army. And I think, you know, that brings it back to, I suppose, a bigger question, and the whole issue of occupation, that I think it's impossible that any occupation can also uphold basic human rights. I mean, I think the two things are mutually exclusive.
Very much so. Isn't it also a fact that Israeli soldiers routinely arrest people to turn them into informants or as a cover for informants that they already have? They try to intimidate people into becoming informants before they give them a permit to get medical help, for example, or to get a job.
There have been some recent reports about medical patients seeking to leave Gaza, and in order to get a permit to get medical treatment, they first have to have an interview with the Israeli security agency. And if they don't cooperate, in some cases, they're denied the exit permit. It's obviously a very sensitive issue, any sort of discussion of collaboration and what have you. What we have found is, in almost every case, children during interrogation are asked by the interrogator, you know, given some sort of inducement or enticement. And typically they're asked to, you know, inform on who's throwing stones in the village, you know, what are all the children in the village doing. Naturally enough, no one tells you that, you know, they succumbed to that. Everyone says, you know, they didn't provide the soldiers with any information, which is perfectly understandable. So it's very difficult to know the scale of the problem. I mean, you hear a lot of anecdotal evidence. All we know is that during interrogation, there are a lot of attempts made to try and recruit people.
I understand you succeeded in delivering a copy of the report to President Jimmy Carter when he was in the area?
Yes. I think he got a copy of it. So certainly the Carter Center got a number of copies. And representatives of the Carter Center informed us that prisoners' rights, you know, children and adults, were a particular concern of the president, and that he personally has been taking that issue up with Israeli authorities, which, you know, is very pleasing to hear, and hopefully some good will come of it.
That's great. Let me mention, for the benefit of our listeners, that the entire report is available in PDF form from the website www.dci-pal.org. www.dci-pal.org. The sentence that you mentioned under the title of the subtitle of the report is really quite telling. It says, "The systematic and institutionalized ill-treatment and torture of Palestinian children by Israeli authorities." And this brings to mind the position of Israel's High Court of Justice on the matter of torture. The High Court, as I understand it, deliberately chose to take a very murky approach to torture, neither banning it nor condoning it outright. And I'm thinking of a September 1999 ruling. I don't know if a subsequent ruling in the 10 years since has repealed that ruling. But in the 1999 ruling, the court legitimated, if only by implication, the use of torture and ill-treatment of prisoners. As reported by B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, the High Court seemed to agree that there were so-called proper circumstances, quote-unquote, under which which was a necessity defense for torture.
It was a very unfortunate decision because, as I'm sure your listeners know, the UN Convention Against Torture, which the US is a signatory to, all European countries are, Israel is, 146 countries have signed this convention, is completely unambiguous and clear on this point.
It completely forbids the citing of exceptional circumstances.
Yeah, Article 2.2 says no exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether a state of war or a threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency, may be invoked as a justification of torture. It's very clear there are no circumstances where torture is legitimate. What the High Court did in 1999, they started off with that position. They said torture is prohibited. We've signed this convention, it's completely prohibited. But then they just resiled from that in the rest of the judgment, and they spoke about the defense of necessity, and that is under the Israeli domestic criminal code. There's a defense of necessity, and they said in certain circumstances, if an interrogator were to torture someone, and you know it was what they termed a ticking bomb case, so you had to torture someone to get the information as to where a bomb was about to go off. The court said, well, in those circumstances, it may be that interrogator could use as a defense the defense of necessity. They said this doesn't authorize torture in advance, but the interrogator might get off, you know, through this defense, which clearly is wrong in law. It's it goes completely against the UN Convention Against Torture. And the problem is that when you start resiling from the clear prohibition and start putting in exceptions and making it, you know, a little bit murky, people take advantage of that. Another point I think that I should mention that we tried to bring out in this report is there's this abuse and torture of children and adults occurs in a environment of almost complete impunity. The organization you referred to, B'Tselem, an Israeli human rights organization, has conducted a study, and I think between 2001 and 2008, 600 complaints were made against the Israeli security agency interrogators for alleged ill treatment and torture of Palestinians, not just children, just Palestinians in general. And out of those 600, not a single criminal investigation was opened. And I think that says a lot.
It also mirrors almost exactly what the United States has used as a defense for torture. And is continuing to use to make sure that the documents pertaining to the torture of prisoners at Guantanamo are never released.
I think from time to time, most countries, most people in authorities try to come up with some sort of justification for torture, which is why I think this is human nature, which is why the people who drafted Article 2.2 made it so clear that there are no circumstances whatsoever to justify torture, because it really is just a slippery slope if we start going down that path.
Do you recall the use of sonic booms in Gaza? Supersonic jets flying low over homes, causing sonic booms. When Israel was asked about it, one of their generals said, well, you know, we know the limit of sonic booms can be fatal, or we operate just below that level, as if that were reassuring. Now, doesn't torture include the use of painful means Can't we say that the use of pain just below the fatal area is torture? Weren't the sonic booms torture?
What is torture and ill treatment is, there's both an objective test and also a subjective test. You know, well, you might subject an adult to a particular particular treatment, and that might not be torture, but you subject a 12-year-old to that same treatment, and it would be. One thing to bear in mind, though, is the Convention Against Torture not only prohibits torture, but it also prohibits cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, which is something less than torture. So, you know, people could debate whether sonic booms, depending on the effect on people and what have you, amount to torture. But it would be a much easier argument to make that it can amount to cruel and inhumane treatment.
But how many people, how many children in Gaza, for example, became deaf as a result of the sonic booms? There was such a hue and cry and demand for hearing aids just for the children. Do you have an estimate of the number of children who were deaf, who went deaf as a result of the sonic booms?
No. I don't. All I've heard is that, I think the main effect of those sonic booms is the psychological effect on people.
And the deprivation of sleep.
The psychological aspect, can just as much be ill treatment and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment as physical. You know, torture and ill treatment does not have to be physical; it can be mental as well.
And a lot of the actual forays and attacks against villages and cities and homes, destruction of property, is meant to cause psychological damage. When a child sees his or her father and mother abused and mistreated, unable to protect that child, that causes permanent harm, does it not?
It certainly can do. I mean, one thing that may be of interest to your listeners is in May of this year, the UN Committee Against Torture, which is the UN body mandated to oversee the implementation of the Convention Against Torture, reviewed 5 countries, including Israel, all countries who are a signatory to the convention get reviewed every 4 years by the committee, and the committee is made up of 10 independent experts, mostly judges, lawyers, that sort of thing. And the concluding observations, which have been partly reproduced in the report that we issued, are quite critical of Israel. They refer to the consistent and widespread allegations of torture being made, that the ill treatment and torture should be promptly and effectively investigated, and they list a whole list of recommendations that they say Israel should adopt in order to make sure they're in compliance with their obligations under the convention. But I think something that's quite disturbing is the committee reviewed Israel 4 years before and basically said the same thing, and very little ever changes. Now, that's not the committee's fault. The committee can just do its job, report, review the evidence, and issue concluding observations. It's got no coercive power. But I think it's disturbing that countries that have signed a legally binding document to say they will adhere to these principles seems to just year after year ignore them,
and basically those comments are hardly a slap on the wrist.
No, and your listeners can read the whole. The link is in the report. You can read the full concluding observations, which I think are about 13 pages, which is on the UN website.
There is no way by which they can be brought to account for deliberately ignoring the United Nations recommendations.
Not in that particular situation, but I mean there is plenty of law about. It's a question of whether people have the will to enforce it. Like this, these are breaches, grave breaches of the Fourth Geneva Convention, and under Article 147 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, personal criminal liability attaches. So people who commit torture can potentially be tried under universal jurisdiction in any court in any country in the world, depending on whether the domestic legislation has been passed to implement the Geneva Convention, which it has in many, many countries. But it just requires governments to take these legal obligations seriously and start putting some resources into it and taking these obligations, like I said, seriously.
Yes, but these obligations are usually trumped by politics on the part of the governments themselves. Yeah. Now, I have one last question, if I may. And is there a technical requirement on the part of a country, perhaps not the Palestinian Authority because it doesn't represent a country, but is there a technical requirement for a country to demand such an investigation before it can be launched?
Under the Fourth Geneva Convention, each country has an active obligation and duty to search out and arrest and prosecute anyone. If they receive credible evidence of torture, they have this positive duty. So, for example, if an official, if there's credible evidence against an official, they've committed torture, and then they land in another country which is signatory to the Fourth Geneva Convention and has implemented its provisions into domestic law, then that country has an active obligation to arrest that person and prosecute them.
Yes, unfortunately, here we're dealing with internal law that countries routinely trump. My question goes to whether a country can demand that the United Nations prosecutor take something into launch an investigation, regardless of universal jurisdiction.
Yes, yes. Off the top of my head, I don't know, but there would always be means through which that could be done, but it would probably require a vote of the Security Council, and with vetoes, and again we run into the political problem.
Mm-hmm.
That, a single country could not do this, could not demand that action be taken. It would require a vote, and as with as we see on many, many occasions, the vote can be political, and the powers of veto and what have you. So it would run into that same difficulty.
Could it be the General Assembly?
I don't know. It's possible, but I think there are issues of whether the Security Council was already seized of a matter, and in certain circumstances the General Assembly can't act. But I don't know off the top of my head exactly what the process would be in that situation. But I think what is important is for your listeners to know is there are things we can all do. You can sometimes feel a bit helpless when you hear all this.
Yeah.
But I think the first thing I'd ask them to do is, if they're interested, do read the report, and then the recommendations and suggestions about what people can do in the back. But also, America is such a key player, obviously, in all of this. And it's important that I think Americans are active and engage with their congressmen, women, as much as possible. This is a lot of their American tax dollars are sent to Israel every year, and they have a right to know what that money is being spent on and how it's being used.
Mm-hmm.
All people around the world, basically, who can get involved and ask people, call people to account, ask them where the money is going, what are they doing, how are they voting on certain issues. I think that can, over time, start to change public opinion and create pressure.
Let me take this occasion to repeat the fact that the entire report is available in PDF form at the website www.dci-pal.org. Is there anything that we may have that we may not have mentioned that you believe is important?
I think reiterating my last point, and that is that people should never feel that they can't make a difference, and that it's one person is too insignificant to change things that involve such big issues at such high levels. I think we must all feel that there are things we can do, and I would encourage people to read the report, read some of the ideas we have of what people can do, and engage in the political process as much as possible to affect change.
Thank you so much, Mr. Gerard Horton, for being our guest today. It was a pleasure to have you. We wish you the best of luck for your very difficult endeavors.
Thanks very much.
My pleasure, sir. And that is all we have for today. We wish our listeners a pleasant and restful weekend and look forward to having you with us next week, same time. Until then, this is Sherif Pham signing off for now and reminding our listeners to get involved.